Welcome to the Wrath of the Iotians podcast. We're two Gen X friends who discuss fantasy, horror, and science fiction books and topics. This is episode 25, an interview with Marina J. Lostetter, the author of The Helm of Midnight and Activation Degradation. I'm Ron in Seattle. As always, Jake in Boston is here. He's going to handle today's interview. We're really happy to have Marina J. Lostetter join us today on the Wrath of the Iotians podcast. She's a prolific writer. First, there's the acclaimed science fiction series, The Numenon, and the sequels Numenon Infinity and Numenon Ultra, which are available from Harper Voyager. Lifeboats and Illustrious are short story collections. She also has numerous short story fiction publications such as Galaxy's Edge and Uncanny Magazine. Marina also has a blog website, A Little Lost, which is lostetter.wordpress.com, and she's contributed to tie-in materials for the Aliens franchise, and even has a YouTube channel where she reads from her work. Marina's here today to talk about her latest novels, The Helm of Midnight, which is her first fantasy novel and the first book in the Five Penalties trilogy, which was published by Tor in April 2021, and Activation Degradation, a futuristic novel exploring artificial intelligence through a conflicted robot hero, which was recently published by Harper Voyager in September 2021. You might think that Marina's taken a well-deserved break, but The Cage of Dark Hours, the second book of the Five Penalties trilogy, will be published by Tor in 2022. She's originally from Oregon and now resides in Arkansas. Marina, welcome to the Wrath of the Iotians podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'm actually astonished by your biography. It makes me feel really sad and insignificant.
But, I don't feel like that.
You had a very busy year. So yeah, and you have two great books, both of which I've read, at least one of which I'm looking forward to a sequel on, hoping maybe there will be a sequel to the other.
Yeah.
But these are two very different books, frankly, in two genres that are often regarded holistically. What was your process? Was it the same for each novel, or did you use different approaches for each? Because they are very different.
Yeah, every book is different, unfortunately. It would be great if I just had a process. I was like, this is exactly how it's going to go. I'm going to do X, Y, and Z, and then I'll have a novel. Unfortunately, that's not usually how it goes. I do most of the time start off with an idea and kind of a picture in my head of where I'm going, like the ending, and then I can work through the plot and that kind of thing. So The Helm of Midnight actually started off as a short story that was published in 2012. And then it kind of evolved from there into a novella that only had one point of view, which was Krona's point of view. The book itself has three points of view. And then later I just added the others in and it just kept expanding until it got to its current form. Activation Degradation, I was like, you know what? I want to write a fast-paced, action-y thing and I want to do it in five parts and there's going to be five chapters in each part. And it just worked out that way, which was amazing. So each process was totally different.
There's a ton of world building going on in Helm of Midnight, whereas the other book is like very focused, right? Kind of razor focus, particular, you know, location almost. So which one was easier to write? I mean, I have a sense of which one was easier to write, but I don't want to second guess you.
Well, Activation Degradation was definitely faster to write.
Yeah.
It's like half the length of the other one. Well, that one, because it was so focused and there is only one point of view, it was easier to just kind of like start and run right through to the end. Because the other one started a short story, which was the short story is a completely different point of view than the novella was. And then I, you know, mashed up. That was definitely a much more like tentacled type process to go through. So yes, Activation Degradation was easier.
Do you outline?
I sort of outline. So I do consider myself a plotter, but it's all very train of thought, very, you know, I sit down when I'm going to start a new novel and I just open a Word document and I just kind of like write this happens and this happens and this happens and this happens. And often there'll be like contradictory things where I'm just coming up with ideas. And if anybody tried to actually like write a novel from that document, they'd be like, what the heck is this? I know what's good and what's garbage in it, but it's just very, you know, train of thought, free form. All right, what am I doing? What am I trying to, you know, where am I going? Sort of a thing. So I do, but it's a very messy process.
Gotcha. Did you have the map before you started Helm of Midnight or did that evolve out of the narrative?
That evolved later. Yeah, the map is actually based on a real place. Nobody's noticed yet. So I kind of don't want to give it
I'm
away.
I'm looking at it right now.
People need to stare at the map some more.
Huh.
It's a real place. Nobody's guessed where that is.
Is this Earth? Or you don't have to give anything away.
It's a real place, but no, it's not on Earth.
All right, I got this, like, maybe in the distant future, this is what happens. God, it's It seems kind of sad. You have wasteland everywhere. But
yeah. So the map is yeah, it's based on a real place, but it's not, that's not like a giving away anything about the story. It's fully secondary world fantasy.
Gotcha.
So it's not like, oh, surprise, it's actually here. It's not.
Do you want to give us an overview of the plot of Helm of Midnight?
The Helm of Midnight follows Chrono Hervath, who's a regulator, who's kind of like a white collar crime fighter, on her investigation of a serial killer's mask. So in this world, there are basically five types of enchantments. The one that we mainly focus on in book one are the masks that can be imbued with the knowledge of somebody who has died. Well, somebody illegally made one out of a serial killer's mask and is now using that mask to kill again. So it's her job to track that person down and bring them to justice. So that's really the core. Excellent. The book. And along the way, we learned some shaky world building things where not everything is quite as it seems.
As it seems. Correct. Yes. Yeah. And you half answered another one of my questions, which but we'll keep plugging on. In terms of the fantasy writing, are there any particular authors or television series or movies, like anything that kind of serves as an influence to you, or is you kind of just diving into this? Because this is your first fantasy novel, right?
It is, but yeah, I'm a huge fan of fantasy and science fiction in general. So there's definitely flavors of Brandon Sanderson in this, but there's also, I realized kind of like after I had finished the book, I've been really influenced by the Final Fantasy video games.
Sure.
In terms of the way they structure a lot of their plots, is very much like, here's the plot. And then we're actually going to like destroy our own world building as we go through. And that's kind of how my story brain functions a lot, is here's the world, here's the setting. I'm going to tell you how everybody inside the world thinks it's functioning, but it's not functioning like that at all.
Gotcha. Final Fantasy VII saved my life, by the way, but I won't go into that.
Oh, yes?
Yeah, no. But it resonates, definitely resonates. So I was going to ask you about the magic system, which you've kind of gotten into, and I've actually seen a number of websites that discuss magic system cliches.
Oh, yes.
But there are no cliches in this book relative to the magic system. It's pretty unique, right? So it's not something that's been done before. How did you get there? Particularly the death mask. Like
the death mask. So the mask started out first. So within the novel, there is the short story is actually still in the novel.
Belladino.
Yes, Belladino's mask. So that actually, I was trying to come up with a short story idea and I was like, I'm just going to use items around my house. And I had recently returned from my honeymoon. And this was actually back in 2011. So this is how long this story has been evolving from. And we got married in Costa Rica and we got some Baruku masks that are just beautiful, beautiful balsa wood carved masks. And I just looked at them on the wall and I was like, oh, what if those were magical? And then I think I had like heard like time in a bottle or something recently. And I was like, oh, and you know, time is money. And I was like, what if also magically time is money?
Time was money.
So it was just kind of like random things in my environment that came together. And then I just kind of from there, like definitely in the first short story, it was only those two types of enchantments. And then I just expanded it to a system of five. So that I ended up with enchantments made out of wood, enchantments made out of glass, enchantments made out of gemstones, enchantments made out of metal, and then something else that is mysterious and nobody knows.
That's actually the way Ray Bradbury had this room full of stuff, and he would just look around his room and fixate on a particular object, and then that was the inspiration for a story. So you and Ray Bradbury have a similar approach. You're in good company.
We're on the same page. Yeah.
The known world that Chrono Melody and is it Carbon? How should I pronounce his name?
So I've been asked this a bunch of times because I pronounce his name multiple ways. So people can pronounce his name. I say Louis. I say Louis. I say Carbon. I say Charbon because my brain at different times just looks at it and says it differently. I don't know why. So I'm very cool with however you want to pronounce it.
Okay, good. Because I pronounce it a bunch of different ways myself. Yeah. Ron and I actually both took French classes together. Little known story, ladies and gentlemen. And I can't really speak a lick of it, but I think maybe it's Carbon. I don't know.
I've taken no French, so blame that entirely on me deciding to throw
definitely a Francophilia that manifests itself at certain times in this novel. That's kind of neat, actually. So their world, the known world, is really pretty confined, right? Yep. And beyond that, there'd be monsters, right? Yep. And you got your bestial Varger. Mm-hmm. that probably
also
works.
Also fine to pronounce
either, either way, also, that figure prominently, right? And they're not even the worst of them, right? How did this world get so inhospitable?
I
don't think it's a spoiler.
No, I think it's fine. So the creation myth, the entire world, essentially, the livable world is in a valley. It's confined to this valley that is a protected space. And it's protected by a magical border.
Shown here.
Yes, yes.
You can't see it.
It's protected by a magical border that was created by the gods when they basically sacrificed themselves to protect the humans from the creator entity that was like, the creator entity basically made the planet and all of the monsters and then made the gods because it was lonely. And then the gods were like, we're going to try to make something too. And they made these fragile little weak things called human beings that all the monsters kept trying to eat. And so they're like, hey, can we not eat our people? And the Thalo, who's the creator god, was like, nah, you made the weaklings, you know, that's your fault. So they ended up making the valley to protect all the humans from the outside monsters and sacrifice themselves in the border to do that. So they're theoretically trapped on the borderland, but nobody's ever been able to get to them.
But we may see them in.
But we may see them.
Maybe.
Possible. Maybe.
Maybe. So Helm of Midnight has, it's got several scenes that are, to my way of thinking, they're effectively horror, right? Particularly gothic horror, right? Horror writing. Yeah. And especially the ones focused on Carbon. Were you aiming for scares when you conceived of this book? Or did they sort of evolve out of the narrative as you wrote?
I think it evolved out of the narrative. Like the tone, definitely. I was dealing with the serial killer, so it just went dark.
Sure, it did.
You know, it just went that direction naturally.
I ask this because we love all genres here. But what do you think makes for good horror writing?
This is tough because so my husband often, he can't understand me because I will put out a lot of horror and I can't take in a lot of horror. So I like horror things, but I like watch them at a distance. Summary. So he will watch movies and be like, yes, you can handle this one. No, you can't. So
This is not unfamiliar to me. So I
enjoy horror, but in small doses. And I definitely am the type of person who like, I know it's fake, but my body's reacting like it's real. Right? Mm-hmm.
So I guess
really
like
good horror writing would theoretically invoke that same kind of
a visceral reaction.
Actual visceral reaction. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you see a horror novel in your future? Because there's some good stuff in here. I'm not going to lie.
I do like writing horror. It's weird how much easier it is to come out than go in. I don't know. Yeah. What's that about? I'm not sure.
Okay, I think I got you. Well, hopefully so. I'm sure that maybe the next book will be dark and creepy too. I hope so.
The next book in the Five Penalty series is definitely dark and creepy.
Excellent. So the relationship, to move to a brighter topic, the relationship between Crona and Delia is sort of central to the narrative, right? And the mutual concern they have and the respect that they have for each other really shines through. So these are two sisters. Crona actually reports to Delia. She is her superior. But there are changes over the course of the narrative and that dynamic between who the caregiver is and who the care recipient is, right? Who's taking care of whom? This may be too personal question. I don't know, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Are you a sibling or was there some other inspiration for this relationship? It's really well developed. It feels lived in.
I am a sibling. I have one full brother and two step siblings. So I have three siblings.
Did some of that inform your writing? Or
I think it did to a degree, but the sister's relationship is very different from the kind of relationship that I share with my siblings.
Yeah.
So I don't think any of us are two mentor-mentee. I'm the oldest. So I guess I'd be more on Delia's.
I am too. And it's very, side. It's a sad place to be. It's not easy.
I don't think I have any of them hero worshiping, but whereas Corona definitely hero worships Delia.
So. All right. I definitely sympathize with that. So the book doesn't, you sort of answered this question, but it doesn't quite feel like a cliffhanger, right?
A complete arc.
You get a complete arc. It's much better than Empire, right? It's satisfactory or satisfying in and of itself, right? But it does leave us with a large number of unanswered questions.
Mostly world building related.
Exactly. So it's next year, right? What's the pub month? Can you tell us?
August.
August. Okay. Yes. That's kind of a long way off.
Yeah. Well, I literally just turned in the manuscript.
All right. Okay. Maybe if you have a NetGalley subscription, you might get an early hold on it. We'll see what happens. Right. But I'm really looking forward to that. Both of these books are very inclusive, right? Helm of Midnight, you've got the relationships. You've got the gods in Helm of Midnight and the relationships amongst the crew members of the Violent Delight, which I hope even saying that doesn't give anything away. And there's a refreshing kind of matter of factness about it. So we've talked about their positive relationship between the two sisters, Crona and Delia. But there's also kind of empathy and a moral gravity to the protagonist of your other book that we could all use more of. Unit 4, a.k.a. Amesley, really has a moral gravity to it that we could all use a little more of right now, I think. Do you see genre fiction as having a role to play in the world just besides pure entertainment?
Science fiction especially is very obviously forward-looking in general. So I feel like it is the genre of progressive thought just in general, because progress has to keep being made, right? You're always moving forward. You're always moving. So you're always looking towards, okay, what is going to change and what's going to change for the worse and what's going to change for the better. And as an author, you get to pick which things you want to discuss and which things you want to just normalize. There are clearly things that I just want to normalize about who's included in stories and who gets to be the heroes.
Yeah, that's pretty great. You know, we've been dealing a lot with Tor, and it's nice to see that list. It's really become important, I think, to at least the science fiction and fantasy readers to kind of extend that readership in a kind of a welcoming way that I think is pretty refreshing, considering where I came from back in the dark ages. So we've really come a long way. So I have to ask, and I'm going to say it again, and I don't think it's a spoiler because people don't know anything about it. Is Violent Delight a nod to Shakespeare, or is it a wink? Or is it a wink to Westworld's nod to Shakespeare?
No, it's okay, a nod to Shakespeare. I have actually not seen Westworld.
You haven't seen Westworld?
No.
Oh, man. All right. Don't watch. Well, you watch the Yul Brynner. Well,
I've seen the original Westworld.
You've seen the
original? Okay. I've seen the original Westworld. I haven't seen the new TV Westworld.
Yeah, the original is pretty cheesy, but the new series is it's just awesome. You got to watch that. But actually, it plays a part. It's the code phrase that occurs at some point. Not to give anything away to people who might not have seen
but that's good. If you thought it was a secret Westworld nod, that might also play right in.
I was wondering because it would fit that it's a Westworld nod, right? Well, I mean,
it would, yeah.
Yeah, you sort of know why, right? So Unit 4/ Amesley, and I hope that's not giving anything away.
It's fine.
Just naming names.
We can it what whichever name for nobody knows why
it has two names. All right. So it has been compared. I'm just gonna say it. It has been compared to Murderbot, which we've talked about Murderbot in this series. I'm not gonna play favorites, I think that's unfortunate because, you know, although I understand why publishers are looking for a bunch of analogs, particularly successful ones, to kind of promote the books, that after you get past the first two chapters of Activation Degradation, it's like the comparison, like it just doesn't work anymore. Something totally different going on, right?
I understand.
Yeah. So, well, of course you understand, but
I do. I get you.
But listeners, do you understand? And anybody who made that comparison, do you understand? I don't know. To your mind, also without giving too much away, what makes Unit 4 like unique? What's different about Unit 4?
Without giving too much away.
Without giving anything away. You can't talk at all about the plot.
I know. This one's hard. This one was very different because it was like entirely, because I was actually inspired by Velocity Weapon, which my friend Megan wrote, which she did some very skillful, unreliable narration. And I was like, what if I did a book that was just entirely unreliable narration? So that's why this one is so difficult to talk about, because literally every other section you're getting turned on your head because the thing you thought before was not the right thing.
Or is it?
It's just back and forth. So, okay. Unit 4 is very earnest in everything it does. It's trying to do its best and it wants people to be safe and it wants to do the right thing. So everything that it does is informed by that base function. And because it is constantly getting new information about what it means to keep people safe or what it means to be doing its job or what it means to be doing the right thing, it's constantly taking a right turn into doing something else because it's like, oh, I thought it was, oh no, that's wrong. I need to relearn because I'm just breaking out into the world where I have been told one thing and now I see another. So I think its earnestness is really important to the character.
I would agree. Knowing Unit 4 as I do.
Yes.
So very well. So did you actually consider writing the novel in the first person? It is from Unit 4's point of view.
Yes.
Entirely.
Right.
But not in the first person.
I think I just tend to be more comfortable in third person. Mm-hmm. That's just where I naturally fall. Once in a while, I'll do something in first or even in second person, but mm-hmm. third is just my comfort zone. So,
gotcha. A writer I like very much kind of evolved from first person into third person. So you've instantly made that evolutionary leap as opposed to.
I'm just, yeah, this feels right to me.
Fantastic. I also have to ask, is this the last we've seen of the crew of Violent Delight? If they survived,
If whatever happens, happens, I would love to write another book. Obviously, this one is standalone in the sense that it's beginning to end.
It feels complete. It really does.
All wrapped up. It is one story. You don't got to worry about being like, no, where's the rest? It's done. But I think if there was enough love for it, I definitely have more places to take.
Yeah. The thing is, I do sort of love Unifor. I'm not going to lie to you. But this is a complete, it feels finished. Right. In a way that the other one, I want that second book. I don't really have any more questions for you.
Yeah. I just had one myself, Marina. Like,
sure. Yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned that The Cage of Dark Hours, the manuscript was just turned in to mm-hmm. the publisher. And were you working on Activation Degradation in parallel with The Cage of Dark Hours?
Or do you?
Yeah. I was just amazed by that. I mean, we're looking forward to The Cage of Dark Hours. It's amazing that you're so prolific, but the quality writing is incredible. So
thank you.
We want to applaud that more, that the writing, the output is, although amazing, you can write two books at the same time. It's just,
the writing itself is
still standing. Yeah, I know.
We've been working on it since college.
I know. Yeah.
Yeah. So is the next one this big? You also can't see this at home, listeners, but it's a good size home.
That size. I think that I'm trying to remember what the font. I think that one's 175,000-ish. And I think the one I just turned in is like 169 right now. So depending on where we go in edits and stuff, but yeah.
Unless you have a vicious slasher for a copy editor.
Right. Well, Marina, we really thank you for joining the podcast today. We're officially fans of you. And
thank you.
And we want to reiterate that Helm of Midnight is now available. Read it now so you can get ready for the second book of the Five Penalties trilogy, The Cage of Dark Hours. And Activation Degradation is also available. Again, both are just wonderful novels. It's amazing that you can write two novels at the same time. But again, we applaud the writing.
Thank you.
Period. It's a terrific read. So we highly recommend our listeners to add up to your reading list. Marina's blog website is lostetter.wordpress.com. And you can follow her on Twitter at Marina Lostetter. And you can also check out Marina's YouTube channel. She's very engaging on it. So I definitely say check it out. I love the readings you did for Numenon.
Activation Degradation.
That'd be great. That'd be great. And we'll leave it where you can get a copy of Marina's novels in the show notes. So Marina, thanks for joining us today. And we'd like to invite you back when The Cage of Dark Hours is published. We can't wait to talk to you about that. Yeah, I was going to say, Jake, the reason why Marina didn't watch Westworld, the series, is she's too busy writing books.
I need to watch TV now.
She's not like us.
You're actually Jake producing and I, output. That's the difference. Yeah.
Jake and I, we have all the leisure time just to watch TV.
We just talk about everybody else's stuff. Yeah, that's what we do. Yeah. Unifor, I love you.
Well, that's good
for joining us. I really like Unifor a ton, actually. I'm not gonna lie, Crone is a great character, but Unifor kind of warmed the cockles of my heart.
Wonderful. Well, Marina, thanks, and we hope everything is going well in Arkansas. We hope everything's going
Ask about Arkansas.
Pandemic wise it could be better, but weather wise home life, all that is great. But
we
could get our vaccination right up. That'd be
get vaccinated, in Arkansas, I think.
We're
vaccination fans here. I just got my flu shot today as well. Get all the vaccines.
Well, thanks again, Marina. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you guys.
Thanks.
Take care. We'll hope to talk to you in August, okay?
Absolutely.
Good.
Bye.
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 We totally enjoyed having Marina J. Lostetter on the podcast. For a writer so accomplished, she's so down to earth and really funny. Listeners, we want you to know that we usually do a pre-interview to go over the recording process. It's typically a dry conversation, but Marina, she was so funny. She was making us laugh and put us at ease, and you can hear that in the interview. By the way, that was a great job by Jake. He handled the interview with Marina on his own. That was just awesome. Again, The Helm of Midnight and Activation Degradation are both available now. You can just go to Amazon, Barnes & Noble to get your copy. And remember, you can also go to bookshop.org to find it at an independent bookstore near you. All right, hey, a little preview for the next episode. We're working on the Halloween special. It's going to include Jake's top 5 scariest movies and books, and it's going to be a lot of fun. We'll see you in the next episode.